GTD HD on the 4th and 5th Saturdays of the month for more editions of Heroes in Our Midst. We salute the hero in all of you. Take care.
This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, and Chuck Wolbers, a transition and work experience teacher in the special education department at Tremper High School, also in Kenosha. Now, here is today's Education Matters moderator.
Good morning, and welcome to this edition of Education Matters. My name is Mike Kehoe. I'm your host for this week. And our topic for today is mandatory inoculations, vaccinations, and perhaps some other matters relating to that, and maintaining a healthy environment in schools. And with me for this conversation are three people, and I'll ask each if you'd please say hello and mention your name and your title so that folks can recognize you from your voice.
Okay. Hello, my name's Sue Valeri. I'm Director of Special Ed and Student Support at Kenosha Unified School District.
Good morning. My name is Laura Weiske, and I'm the Secretary for the Immunization Program at Kenosha Unified School District.
Good morning. I'm Diane Bozovich. I'm a public health nurse at the Kenosha County Division of Health.
Okay, and let's begin as we began a few minutes ago when we had our fall start. And would one of you like to start us off by telling us what the Kenosha Unified policy is on school immunizations?
Kenosha Unified's policy follows the state law for Wisconsin immunization program. And all our timelines, all our exclusion is based off of that.
Okay, so the policy that Kenosha Unified follows and probably the policy that any school district in the state would follow would be basically the same. The wording might be a little bit different. I like the way the Kenosha's policy is so nice and concise. But the terms of the policy are dictated by state statute. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And that's where the public health department comes in, right?
Yes. Yes. Our job is to make sure that people have the ability to get the vaccines if they don't have a provider.
All right.
And one of the things, yes. The county health department is an excellent partner with Kenosha Unified School District, and we work to inform our families on exactly what immunizations are required at what age levels. And the secretaries in our buildings do this communication for us. We do it on our website, things like that. But the first thing kids and families are asked for as part of the registration process is their immunization record. Wisconsin also has what they call WIR, W-I-R, Wisconsin Immunization Registry. And that helps us verify immunizations for families who may not have had a copy, lost a copy of their child's immunization. So we, all our secretaries also have access to that, and our principals have access to that. So anyway, then if a family is having problems with getting immunizations or they don't have a family practitioner here, we, being a partner with Kenosha County Health Department, we refer them to them, and they take care of them, and they're right on top of it. And it's at a nominal cost or no cost if they can't afford it. So it's a great partnership. We can make sure our kids get immunized, and then we are all set to go for the school year.
Okay, so they put it this way: the statute requires that they comply within 30 days of the start of school, but
correct.
You notify in advance. You notify
absolutely,
the time of registration.
Yes,
through newsletters, our website, a venue as this on radio, newspaper, It's all taken care of.
And the secretary is with direct contact.
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm glad to hear you say that because so many of the families I work with as a special ed support person at Bullen, they don't have a computer at home. Mm-hmm. And so putting it on the website doesn't reach them. But what kind of compliance do you get?
We have really good compliance. I'm so glad you asked that.
We're so proud of it.
Yes, we are proud of it. In this past year, we were 98.97% compliant. The year before, 99.39% compliant. We've ranged in the 98-99% the last 7-8 years.
Okay. I thought you were indicating you had something to say. I'm sorry. The next question would be, what immunizations are required of the students?
Well, I think Diane can list them pretty well for us.
I'll take that. With children entering kindergarten, by that point in time, they should have had 5 DTaPs, 4 polios, 2 MMRs, measles, mumps, rubella, 2 varicella or chickenpox vaccines, to be fully and 3 hepatitis B vaccines to be fully compliant within the laws. For the older children, they want them 7 and older. They want them to have the adult version of the DTaP, and DTaP is the diphtheria, tetanus, and whooping cough. After age 7, it's called the Tdap, and that's the adult version. It's tetanus, diphtheria, and acellular pertussis. But they'll need at least one dose of that as between grades 6 to 12.
Question that just occurs to me, are there any of those vaccinations that people in later life, as adults, long after they're out of school, that they should have renewed or anything like that?
If they have not had a dose of the Tdap, it's recommended that everyone has a dose of Tdap because it helps protect the infants and younger children around you. Adults may get pertussis or whooping cough and not experience it as severely, but it's in order to prevent the spread of it. They do want every adult to have at least one dose of the Tdap.
And the reason it occurred to me is that this morning on television before I came in here, I was watching Terry Bradshaw talking about shingles and chicken pox.
Yes.
Yes. If anyone has had the chickenpox disease in life, that virus can lodge along a nerve network and later on in life can re-inflame or become what's called shingles. We do have a vaccine for shingles, and it's called Zostavax. It can be given at age 50 and older with a prescription, 60 and older without a prescription, but it's recommended that older adults get one dose, especially if they've had the chickenpox disease.
You know, one of the things that I know, too, is tetanus shot would be important for those people who have had an accident with something. So is a tetanus shot given independently now, Diane, or is that always combined as the Tdap?
It's given independently. I'm glad you asked that. The Tdap is recommended as, like I said, at least once in your life, but when you get, if you do get injured, there is a regular tetanus shot, tetanus and diphtheria. That's recommended for every adult every 10 years.
Yep, that's what I thought, because I think I just recently had to do that.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I did as well. In my case, it was a bird bite for my pet bird, who plays a little rough sometimes. Mm-hmm. There is a procedure, isn't there, for persons who have, for one reason or another, a reluctance to have their children vaccinated?
Yes, we do have some students with health reasons that they do not get vaccinated, religious reasons. So we do have compliance. Laura, do you want to explain this a little bit better?
That's part of the waiver on the immunization card from the state. The state allows 3 different types of waivers. One's a personal conviction, one is religious, and then one is the health. The health has to be signed by a physician, where the religious is based off the parents and along with the personal conviction. It happens. That's a parent's prerogative with the state of Wisconsin. And at all, when we never offer it, but it is part of the state law that parents do have that.
And that Mike, ability, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And Mike, may I mention from my aspect of the health department, a lot of people have hesitancy with vaccines that we've talked to, and a lot of times I believe it's more lack of understanding or lack of not knowing exactly what the vaccines are about. We've done education with a lot of parents, and sometimes we'll talk to them several times, but I've had a lot of people then once they understand what the vaccines are for and that they do protect the children, they usually agree to giving them.
So there are apparently two general situations in which a person could make the objection. One would be a faith-based objection, and there's not much you can do about convincing someone if their belief is faith-based. But would you say the majority of cases are cases where it's a lack of education rather than faith-based, at least in this part of the country?
I would think, Diane, you're correct in that. It's a lack of education about it, knowing really. They're hearing things. They're looking on the Internet where when you educate them and...
Right, and everything on the Internet is not accurate. So it's important to get...
That's for sure.
The right mm-hmm. the right information.
Correct.
Recently, we've seen a big dust up in California over their new legislation having to do with mandatory immunizations, which offers no exemptions whatsoever for children who are attending either public or private schools, with one exception being if there's a medical reason, then the case would be reviewed and it would be determined whether that person could attend school or not. What is the difference between Wisconsin and say California? What if you know what is happening in places like California that is causing this to be so controversial?
You know, I'm not quite sure, but many people have strong beliefs, and they're convinced that this could harm their child. And I think that's the difference between Wisconsin and California. And jump in if you want to say anything. Mm-hmm. But I think that's the big difference is we do give the parents the option if they have a religious belief, a personal conviction, or a health matter. And we do have doctors who recommend against immunizations for students that have health issues. So,
yes. I also want to mention, and I believe I don't have all the information in front of me, but I believe it was 2010 that California had a large pertussis outbreak, where they had over at least ten infants die within a short period of time. They've also struggled with large pertussis outbreaks each year for a couple years after that. Then also in this last year, they had the measles outbreak at Disneyland, and that spread over five states, and as at last count I had read, it was about 146 people who have been affected by that. I believe it's larger since I've seen I haven't seen the most recent statistics on that. Those two events, I think, help become more the catalyst for this legislation in California, and that they wanted to protect. There were a lot of people who are affected that can't be immunized because of their own weakened immune system, but also it helps protect the more vulnerable populations. We need to keep our immunization rates up in order to protect those that can't be immunized.
I think a lot of people, at least people that I know, have the impression that, what happened out there is just an inconvenience. Having measles isn't a major thing. People used to get that all the time in school and stuff like that. But it really is a very costly and serious health threat as well, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And let me give you an example. if someone is in a room who has the active measles disease and they leave that room or area, the measles virus still maintains in the air for at least 2 hours after. So other people coming into that area are at risk of exposure.
And what sort of costs and efforts would be necessary from public health agencies like yourselves to deal with an outbreak like that?
A lot of manpower hours, a lot of interviewing, the cost of a lot of staff to be involved with an outbreak situation.
What kind of things do you have to do when the horse is out of the barn and the disease is out there?
One of the things I know that is communicate with the big agencies, and that's one of the things we can count on from the health department is they communicate with us immediately. So if there's anything we need to do to help prevent further spread of something, they're on the phone with us right away.
Yes, we're in good communication with Kenosha Unified to give them a heads up if there's a potential even, and with the school nurses.
Do you have to be involved with the Communicable Disease Center in Atlanta or anything like that?
We're more in communication with our state.
All right, and they would communicate with the national?
Yes.
And the state makes recommendations, too, for if we need to exclude or for a period of time. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who make those recommendations for us.
The state health department provides a lot of guidance to us on that when we're in particular case-by-case situations.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'd like to change roles for a minute and maybe provide a partial answer to my own question. And this is sort of one of those back when I was in school days type statements. But I was born in 1942. I'm a war baby. And when I was in elementary school, I remember when all of these diseases, including smallpox, were still around. And I can remember that on a number of occasions, school started late at the end of the summer because it was a hot September, and so schools delayed their start times by 30 days because of polio. Mm-hmm. I can remember on another occasion when a student developed smallpox, and the school system in the town shut down for a period of time until they could search carefully. Just recently I can remember when I was called in to fill in for a teacher for an entire year at one of our high schools because that person, the teacher turned out to have tuberculosis. And so those consequences are quite substantial. The other thing is, as someone who has had measles and has had whooping cough and who has had chicken pox, those are not particularly fun things that you want your child to experience. You do end up having your house quarantined, at least we did back then. We were quarantined for a period of time while we had these diseases. I was lucky. My three siblings and I all had chicken pox at the same time. So, and it was the same with measles. Mumps we had separately.
That's common.
Mumps we had separately. But none of those are things that you want to experience or you want to have your children experience.
No, you're right about that, Mike. You're right. And I myself, I did experience some of those childhood illnesses. I still remember the mumps and how painful that was when I had it. But I think, too, some people feel that the childhood illnesses can be almost like a rite of passage to protecting their own immunity, so it's okay to get the diseases. The problem is there are a number of children who do suffer lifelong consequences after having those illnesses. Chickenpox, which is treated very casually, can also have some very severe consequences, and I personally know of several where in one particular case, the teenager acquired it and then became permanently deaf. So there are consequences to some of these illnesses that parents don't realize that they're not as casual.
Are there some concerns that some of these diseases that have been eradicated, like smallpox or polio, that now that no one is being vaccinated against them, particularly in the case of smallpox, and in the polio case, I think that some countries had gotten lax about vaccinating against them, that they might make a resurgence?
Yes, that's true. And in fact, in Africa, they thought they were at the point a few years ago where the polio was possibly totally eradicated, but it did start to resurge. And then with all the complications, political complications in some of those countries, it has become, it's made it difficult for people to receive their vaccinations. And so the virus has resurged and is spreading more. With the world that we see now with travel, anyone can travel anywhere from whatever country and bring with them whatever disease they have, possibly. But they may not realize they're infected, and they can come to the United States and spread it without realizing it.
Now, the polio was the thing that struck me a couple of years ago when there were a few examples of that turned up in Europe and in the Near East. And you're concerned about people traveling to this country. The public had become quite complacent about polio. And I remember that it was something that people were very concerned about, especially in the summertime. Kids weren't allowed out to play. The only place you could go was to the theater if it was mm-hmm. air-conditioned. I had an uncle who had polio, and that was a lifelong consequence for him. And one of my classmates in fourth grade, I believe it was, fourth or fifth grade, had polio. Fortunately, a relatively mild case, but our class went to visit him in the hospital in this small town we lived in, and that memory stays with me because he was in an iron lung in the basement where they had the iron lungs and the hydrotherapy and other things that they didn't have up on the floors. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a good thing that they took us there to see it. And to see him. It was good for him, and it was good for us in terms of precautions. But it was something that that really struck fear in a community every single fall.
Yes.
There are some other situations, public health situations, that the schools deal with of a similar nature. One of them that surfaces probably more often than these diseases would be head lice. Is there a policy on that?
Yes, there is. Kenosha Unified has a policy that's a little stricter than what the state requires right now. And so it requires our kids to be what we call NIT-free, which are the eggs, in order to return to school.
How generally is the condition discovered? I would think that a student could be around in the population in a particular school for some time before it was noticed.
You know, you're right. We also find, though, and you know, chime in, that lice usually isn't spread within the school itself as much as it's spread at sleepovers and parties with kids and things like that. So, and usually if we do find a case of head lice, it's with a family or a group of friends that usually have it. And parents are really good about acting on that. We notify them and the secretaries and the health information people in all our buildings are willing to help. I know when I used to be a principal, I would also help. We'd check heads, you know, of an entire class if we found a student that had head lice. But head lice is not a fatal disease.
Right.
So, and I know the state, maybe Diane, you can talk a little bit about what the state feels, because I know Kenosha Unified's lice policy is stricter than what the state does talk about.
We do have a lot of parents call us, and we do try to provide guidance with them as to the best ways to get rid of the lice. We also try to alleviate their fears, because I think that is one of the topics that creates the most anxiety in parents when we're talking to them, and it creates that anxiety as almost like, you know, it's almost like a fear, I think. We try to calm them down, tell them, you know, how to take care of it, but basically it is a pest problem. It's not a disease. So we want to let them know that there are ways to get rid of it, to just relax, and it will they will be able to treat that fairly easily. I would recommend that they don't use the sprays. A lot of times parents will buy sprays and spray the house and spray everything around the house, but those can cause respiratory problems, and they're really not necessary in trying to get rid of these. And I believe it's a very widespread common problem throughout the school year in different schools. I don't believe there is a school that hasn't experienced it at some point.
Right, absolutely, and I would agree with that. And I really, one of the things we also do at Kenosha Unified is we prefer that if teachers and people in their classrooms do not bring in their old couch with cloth furniture and things like that. So if we do have a case, the rooms, the custodians, our facilities department acts in it, they clean it. And if we did have a cloth old chair or couch in there, it would probably have to be removed because they have a policy now that they don't want that. So if there are any illnesses, lice, any issues, that the room is easily sanitized and clean so we can get rid of it.
There is kind of a stigma, an unfair stigma that attaches to lice, isn't there?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Because it isn't necessarily tied to the lifestyle of a family or the
very true
circumstances of that family. I know of a situation that I will not specifically identify in which a principal in Kenosha Unified developed lice. So
it just occurs whenever if someone has it and they're touching heads or their coats
sharing
are sharing hats, things
brushes.
Like that with other children. Putting their head down in the same place, it's fairly easy to spread.
I hadn't thought of that, but sharing and trading hats and scarves it's part of the social fabric
exactly.
of a middle school anyway.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And that's when we find it. And, you know, truly, if we look back at the cases that we've been dealing with a lot in the past few years, it usually is a group of friends that were together at a party, a sleepover, something like that. That is really common.
Yes.
Wonder if you might comment on what parents can do to help the schools maintain a healthy environment in the school. There's one situation that occurs to me particularly that some of us were talking about before we went on the air, and that is you see posters in schools telling people in flu season, cover your mouth when you cough. I discussed that with my pulmonologist once, and he said that's the worst thing that you can do in a school.
Correct.
He said, because he said you should be coughing up your sleeve or something like this. Because, and I really hadn't thought about this before, but kids are sharing laptops, keyboards.
Mm-hmm.
They are sharing pencils. They are sharing textbooks. They are sharing desktops and all sorts of things. And when you cough into your hand, viral agent,
spread, yeah.
It stays alive for some time.
Yes.
Well, it's kind of funny you say that. We had all our principals a couple of years ago were trained in and asked to go back and teach their teachers that exact thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we do our teachers teach our kids hand washing. That's the best way. You know, I know a lot of people use the antibacterial things, but the best way to get rid of the germs is hand washing. And they actually taught proper hand washing techniques. And we do that in our early childhood classes. our kindergarten classes, our first grade, they're reiterating that all of the time. You know, did you wash your hands? And then they say, when you get the soap on, you're supposed to rub them together. You should say your ABCs and then rinse them. But so we do teach that to our kids. It's funny that you say that, because when that was taught to all the principals a few years ago, we were all kind of chuckling to ourselves that, well, this is part of our in-service. But it's true. That's how you germ spread, is through the hands.
So. Yeah, we all put our hands to our mouths after we've touched things.
That's
Without any thought. And when I thought about how much the laptops are shared in schools these days, because we don't have a laptop for each person, except maybe in Washington, which has a special program.
And I believe that some of those computer areas, they wash down those laptops pretty frequently throughout the day, because they've had more education on that. But also coughing in your sleeve, by coughing in the material and your whatever you are wearing that day, that the germs will only live a few minutes, so that is much more sanitary.
Yeah, especially in the wintertime, I suppose, when
a Kleenex isn't
available. There's a lot of it,
when people are going outside and that sort of thing. Another area that's related to what we've been talking about, that I always feel sorry for the secretarial staffs in the schools, and that's medications, because there are so many kids who have so many different kinds of medications that they have to take in school, and the secretaries are generally in charge of administering those, and it's almost a full-time job at certain times of the year with certain kids. Just what are the rules having to do with medications in schools?
Well, I think we can discuss that. We have forms that have to be filled out by physicians and parents in order to give a medication at a school. And so after all of that is filled out, a nurse, either a county health needs nurse or one of our special health needs nurses or one of the high school nurses, will collaborate with that parent and physician, and then they will get a schedule for the administering of the medication. Many of our schools have what we call health aides in the office to help with this. The only thing that secretaries, health aides, nurses are required to give our prescriptions by mouth. They do not have to. They can if they want to, but they do not have to do any injections. But we have many of our staff who do, because we have kids with diabetes and things like that. But yes, it is part of an office staff job, and there's pretty big record keeping that goes along with it to keep all of our kids safe. It's a lot of work at the beginning of the year, and we urge parents to make sure they've communicated with the school any health problems that there is. Now, we went to an online enrollment, and it's really important that we get parents to fill out all that medical information on the online enrollment, so we can get that set first thing at the beginning of the school year. And our nurses from the health department, they can tell you the first month is really busy getting all that under control.
You're right, Sue. It's very hectic for them. They spend a lot of time reviewing those cards. And for those that don't have complete information, if an illness is indicated, they call to the parents to try to follow up and find out the severity of it. They're also responsible for making sure that any child who has a severe life-threatening allergy or listed, that they have their EpiPens available, and that the EpiPens are in the schools so that the staff have them available.
Certain students who require certain kinds of medical care during the course of the day, are they in the special classes?
Not all of them. It depends on what their disability is. It's if there's just a health issue, but their abilities are the same as everybody else, they're included with everybody else, unless they can't be. So we only have a couple, a few self-contained classes, and that would be for severe intellectual disabilities or some emotional behavior disabilities. But there are, our philosophy in Kenosha Unified is more of an inclusive philosophy. So we try and get our kids into the general education environment whenever we can.
And this is one of the partnerships that Sue had mentioned earlier, that the Kenosha County Division of Health and Kenosha Unified School District have worked so hard together and build up, is to provide a safe environment, as safe an environment for children as possible,
right,
and looking at anything that might be a potential health issue for their students.
And I think we've talked a little bit about training that students, the teachers rather, get over the course of the year, and issues having to do with maintaining a healthy environment in school, and you mentioned nurses. All schools don't have full-time nurses, is that
correct? Unfortunately not. No, unfortunately, no, we don't. But, you know, all staff, I have to give credit to our teachers and principals and educational assistants. They do a phenomenal job with our kids. And our nurses train them on what to expect, what to do, and we practice with them. And they really step up to the plate. I have to tell you, we do have kids with a lot of medical issues in our schools. And I have not encountered problems with the staff. They really do step up. We also created a medication administration class, online class, for all staff to take who are going to administer any medication or take kids on a field trip off school grounds, so they would be prepared to help any student that might get into some difficulty while they're gone.
I believe that you also have teachers trained at a higher level to be on call, for example, in emergencies.
Yes, we do. Yes, you have a crisis team, absolutely.
And
each school principal is required to put that together, and those people volunteer to be on that team, so they would help respond if there was ever an emergency. Yep.
I'd kind of be interested in hearing a little more about that, for the reason that I taught for 1 year at Beach Park Middle School. At Beach Park Middle School, every teacher, every staff member practically, including substitute teachers, we were all trained in the use of the automatic defibrillators,
mm-hmm,
and some other things, and trained in certain responses to certain conditions that we might have to deal with. Is there anything like that in the Kenosha school system?
Absolutely, yes. In fact, I keep getting trained every year. We even have it at the Educational Support Center, our first responders, we call them. But every school is required to have first responders. We certify them in CPR and first aid, and that does include the defibrillators. So they practice on that. So we've had anywhere from our nurses help certify us to certified instructors in CPR from our high schools, or the fire department has helped certify us. We also teach them basic first aid techniques, and if there was a break, what to do if a student was bleeding and you couldn't stop the bleeding, what to do. The principals have the procedures in their schools. Secretaries are really good at, one, communicating 911 if necessary, and then any other help. But whenever I get involved into a situation, I've usually found those first responders have just done a phenomenal job.
Yeah, and I've noticed that teachers are very familiar with issues having to do with bodily fluids and things like that.
Yes. At first, it was a little hard. You had to get used to it, but now it's common, and they are pretty good about it.
Excellent at it. Yeah.
Any conditions that have arisen or that you're prepared to deal with having to do with HIV? Is that an issue at all?
Actually, no, it's not an issue. We wouldn't, if we were aware of a student with HIV, we couldn't divulge that. So
right.
It would be our normal practices of making sure our buildings are clean, our kids are washing hands, those types of things.
And that's why universal precautions are so stressed with everyone for handling any emergency, is because you never know what you're going to encounter, so you have to be protecting, you know, cognizant of protecting yourself as well as the person you're dealing with.
And I think concerns that used to be pretty strong and vocally expressed frequently regarding HIV, with the public now understanding that it's only spread through certain ways, it can't be spread through coughing and that sort of thing, that there is not the fear of the risk that there used to be.
I would agree with that.
Yes.
I would agree with that. Those universal, like Diane said, those universal strategies are stressed with our kids.
Okay, well, we don't have an old clock on the wall, but we do have a digital chronometer here. And it tells me that our time is just about up. So I would like to thank Diane and Laura and Sue Valeri for being here. I hope you enjoyed your experience. The information was certainly informative. And especially to you listeners who tuned in. I'd like to also make you aware of our growing Facebook site, which is WGTD:Education Matters. That site is updated at least twice a day. It's it may be your best source of information, news, and analysis. At least we're trying to make it that on the subject of education. And we've referred to some documents here, statutes and school policies. And next Monday, when this program is available on the archive site, WGTD.org, I will have sites to those documents if you want to go to them. All of our programs on Education Matters are archived, and they are all available on the WGTD.org website. We know that 10:30 on Saturday morning is not the most convenient time for a lot of people to listen, and so we make it available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, so that you can listen at your own convenience, and you can find out about what programs are on and what programs have been on by checking the Facebook site. So with that, we'll say goodbye for the week. I'm not sure who the host is that's going to follow me next week or what the topic will be, so we'll just go at that. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Mike.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Support comes from Grady Design Harborside Eye Care, now featuring private label frames that can be customized by size and color to your liking, specializing in thorough eye exams and superior one-on-one service. For an eye exam or frame viewing appointment, Grady Design Harborside Eye Care, 262-652-2020. Support comes from Gateway Technical College. Tired of lame websites? Gateway's Junior Web Developer Program can make you a star in business website development. Great web developers are in big demand as e-commerce grows. Get started at gtc.edu/programs.
Support for WGTD comes from Vero International Cuisine in Racine on 6th Avenue near Monument Square, featuring American food with an international twist in a serene setting with intimate and exotic touches. Online at verointernationalcuisine.com. This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Marlo Harmon, a lifelong Racine resident who's currently employed as an addiction counselor at Racine Correctional Institution. And now, here's today's host.
Good morning, I'm Jim McClure, and I take you now to Horticultural Hall, the 1911 structure in Lake Geneva, appropriate for the Lake Geneva Historic Preservation Commission's memorable meeting last weekend called Tales of Lake Geneva, where local residents shared their recollections of the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s. beginning with Burley Brelathan, a longtime owner of the Chevrolet dealership,